Hello, innovators, explorers, and risk takers. Welcome to another episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. I'm your host, Sam Kamani, an Amazon best-selling author, a multiple exit founder, and a strategic advisor to startups in Web3 and artificial intelligence. In this episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast, I'm interviewing Mauricio Magaldi. Mauricio is a man of many talents. He has been in a band back in the days. He has been a CrossFit trainer. He is a podcast host and advisor and a board of multiple startups, and also currently works at 11FS, which is a venture studio. But most of all, Mauricio is an expert when it comes to blockchain, the future of blockchain and crypto, and he is an analyst because he has been analyzing hundreds and hundreds of companies and technologies in this space. In this episode, we discuss if there is even a need for blockchain. We discuss the use cases. Since he has worked with hundreds of startups in his life, we talk about things such as what makes good Web3 founders different. What are they doing differently? What mistakes Web3 founders are making? How do they avoid them? And so much more. So if you are building a product in Web3, then this episode is for you. Finally, nothing mentioned in this podcast is an endorsement or an investment advice. Do your own research. Moreover, we do not mention any token prices or anything like that on this podcast. This podcast is all about the technology and the growth and the adoption of this sector and the use cases that you can find that are beneficial that you can build on. And one last thing, and that is I do not run any ads on this podcast. My only ask is that you go and share and review this podcast on whatever platform you are listening to. With all that out of the way, let's get into it. Mauricio, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to interview you. It's great to have you here. It's an honor. So looking forward to interviewing you, especially given your background that you have managed or you have advised over 17 different startups, and you're currently on the board of nearly 10 different startups. That's more than most people I know who are in this field. So congratulations on that. And also for your podcast and for 11FS and everything that you are doing. For some of the people who don't know you a bit or your background, can you quickly give us a bit of an overview of your background or how you got involved in Web3?
Absolutely. Hey, Sam, thanks for having me. Such a pleasure. I've been catching up to your back catalog of interviews. Amazing. Your new show. Congrats on your new show.
Thank you.
Yeah, super fun. I'm Mauricio. I'm a Brazilian born and raised. I've been in financial services for over 20 years. I have a run into Bitcoin, the Bitcoin white paper back in 2014. And that blew my mind. And that blew my mind for probably the simplest reason, which was Bitcoin solved the double spend problem. So when you send an email to someone, you send a copy of that email to that person, and you keep a copy of that email, which means that you double the amount of that email that exists on the internet. If you do that with money, you create a inflationary money that reduces value. And back when I was starting off with my band, like late 90s, and Napster came about in the same year that we launched our first record, no record company would pick us up because they couldn't know what possibly would happen with the music industry. And we all know what happened with the music industry. The music got devalued. Music lost its value almost completely. And at every interaction and evolution of technology we have, music increasingly loses more and more value. So now you can pay $9.99 and have the whole library of music in the world at your fingertips through streaming. And guess what? The musicians getting paid for that, getting less and less, right?
Yes.
So this is the story of technology and music in a nutshell. But what blew my mind was like, okay, so if this thing existed back when we launched Versover's first album and it was in digital form, then we might have had a shot at having a music career instead of going like finish engineering school and working in financial services and doing all these other things, we could have pursued music as a career because then we wouldn't have music being devalued. And that applied to many things in the digital space, especially digital money, which is what Bitcoin ultimately is, right? To that extent, that was where my mind went. A couple of years later, I was hired by IBM to do something completely different. And I had the luck to meet the blockchain lab at IBM. So Nitin Gaur is a great friend, one of the founding members of blockchain labs at IBM. And I started just keeping tabs of what they were doing. And then early 2017, they offered a series of training courses. I flew to San Francisco because no one in my region seemed to care about blockchain. I was the only one. Yeah, I'll go. I was on a consulting gig. I was on the bench and I'm like, I'll get the training. And it was amazing because when I came back, I got offered the blockchain services leadership role for Latin America. And since that point, I never stopped working with stuff that's related to blockchain. So that's my story with blockchain early on. And obviously, I had a day job at IBM selling products and services that related to blockchain in various industries. I was very lucky to be able to branch out into oil and gas and telco and mining and metals and insurance and hospitality, food and CPG, you name it. I had exposure to all of those other industries because in financial services, nobody wanted to touch blockchain because blockchain at that time was like, oh, this is like Bitcoin. I don't want to touch that. And although some of this still exists, that was the very early stage of the positioning of institutions and digital assets back in 2017-18. At that point, I started to be invited for panels and keynotes and lectures, and there was a lot of education that was necessary to create that market. And at that point, founders and builders started to reach out to me to get my opinion and advice on, we're building this. Do you think that this makes sense? We thought of this. Which blockchain should we choose for this? And that became somewhat of a side gig of sorts, very much pro bono, because there was also a way for me to start researching what was going on across industries. And I kept doing it. And yeah, and it's just been a thrilling ride.
That's fantastic. Also, tell me a bit about your engagement with 11FS and what does 11FS do?
11FS is a venture builder. They're known for building fintechs. So in the space of 7 years that the company exists, it's 16 fintechs. Among those, 12 are neobanks, both in the US, UK, Europe, and Southeast Asia. So we have clients all over the world. 11FS also has a product called Pulse, which is the Netflix for UX designers. It's a benchmarking tool, it's an inspirational tool. It's made by designers for designers. And I think we're in 60 countries with that product. All of Latin America, US, UK, Asia, Middle East, all you name it. So yeah, it's been a thrilling ride. I'm currently their global strategy director for crypto, which means that I do high-end advisory for C-levels and boards that are trying to enter crypto, but they don't know how. And they don't know how crypto or Web3 or DeFi play a part in their strategy. And that's what I help them with. I sit in the middle between TradFi and DeFi. So I help them bridge the understanding and also build product roadmaps, labs, experimentation projects, and pitch for funding for their own board. So it's a very interesting gig. And it helps a lot because not only that, I have a side responsibility within 11FS, which is one of the things that I like the most is Blockchain Insider. I'm the co-host of Blockchain Insider, which is the firm's crypto podcast. And I share the hosting duties with a good friend, Kai Sheffield, who heads crypto at Visa. And we have the ultimate luck of being able to talk to people from the market that are really amazing and inspiring. So I'm really thankful for that gig.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's always great to talk with like-minded people or people who are achieving and doing things and getting to know the industry more using a podcast. It could be a podcast, could be a blog, could be a YouTube channel, but still it serves the same purpose.
I fully agree. I've been doing Block Drops, which is my Portuguese podcast, since 2019. Because once I left IBM, I didn't want to lose touch with the market. And I wanted to make sure that I continued to study and talk to my friends and all of that. So I just came up with the idea of doing a podcast that talked about building things, not about token go up, token go down. I'm not a trader. I don't understand chart analysis. But I have a bunch of friends who are building great things. And it ended up being my way to also study and doing my own research. So Block Drops is a weekly podcast. It's a digest of the three most important news, in my opinion, because damn it, it's my podcast. and it's also now a newsletter on LinkedIn, so you can keep tabs on the episodes out there. And we are on, I think I'm going to release tomorrow, excuse me, interview number 103rd interview. Yeah, 103.
Nice.
So it's the Block Talks interview segment within Block Drops, which is the weekly podcast. Nice. We're circling around 360 something episodes total. So it's been quite a ride.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, you're doing great. I have a question. So when you have advised all these startups and you're on the board, what are the types of startups you're on the board of or you love to advise? Are they fintech? Are they TradFi, DeFi, CeFi?
No, that's a great question. Because I came up in my career through banking and financial services, I'm very aware of compliance and avoiding conflict of interest and all of that good stuff that comes with being in financial services. So I try to keep things separate as much as I can. Before joining 11FS, I was working as an executive in two banks in Brazil. So I never picked up any financial services startup. I never did because it didn't make sense for me to say, compliance, can you waive this one for me? Come on, Mauricio. You know this, right? I'm not a kid anymore. The white beard tells me that I need to pay attention to some of these things. So I do. So right now I'm advising startups that are in sports, esports, games, prop tech, intellectual property. One is a DeFi and it's waived by 11FS. Tokenization, music, and I think these are all the. And I try to not advise two startups on the same segment. So try to keep that.
There's no conflict of interest.
Yeah, that independence in mind. Usually try that. But the lessons are enormous. One, the speed in which innovation comes about and the speed in which lessons are learned is remarkable. I'm very lucky to be in touch with founders that are very coachable, number one.
Yes.
But number two, very curious as well. Yeah. And they ask the weirdest questions. And for the questions that I don't have answers to, then it forces me to go do some research for stuff that I haven't paid attention yet. So it creates this kind of reinforcing learning loop between me and the founders so we can actually collaborate together. There are startups where my capacity is more like helping with fundraising. So I leverage my network. There are startups where my responsibilities are more mentoring the founder or the founders. So also something that is very specific. And there is obviously the traditional board, advisory board membership where I'm sitting there for an hour every month and listening to the review and the reports and asking questions that would help de-risk the business.
Yes.
So it really varies depending on the stage of the startup. It varies depending on the industry. If I can help more on that industry, I will help more. If I'm new to that industry, then I'll ask silly questions as an advisor will help the founders realize if this isn't clear for someone who isn't from the industry, then we might need to be a little bit more clear about that. So all of this hopefully helps the founders to progress with their businesses. And it obviously helps me to keep tabs on the edge of the industry and what they're doing.
That's very cool. Since you have been talking with this, like a different group of founders from different types of different niches and different industries, have you seen a common pattern of what some of these successful founders are doing?
Because they're in very different industries, the success criteria also varies because the regulation varies. And the need for having an inside legal counsel or an outside legal counsel also varies. But I think A common denominator, I would say, across all of the founders I work with is grit, really, like resilience and this kind of persistent sense of purpose, right?
Yeah.
These people are all very intelligent, all well networked. They could be working corporate jobs and making a lot more money, but they chose to solve a problem they're passionate about solving. And that is a lot. They're not going to bed until they figure out that one problem that's preventing them from progressing that day. So I'm on the UK time zone, and I have founders in Brazil messaging me until I go to bed. And it's midnight here, and they're like 8 p.m. and they're like, I'll send you something for you to wake up to in the morning. And they do. And hell yeah, it's amazing how these things, and then they solve the problem, they move forward, or they hire someone to solve the problem for them. So it's really interesting to see how persistent and resilient and how they understand that if they don't do that, then no one will.
Yeah.
Being an entrepreneur in my very limited experience is like managing your career, right? If you're a very successful corporate employee, you've managed your career really well. Nothing happens for no reason. Everything happens because someone did something. And the most successful employees in corporate world have managed their careers very successfully. Being an entrepreneur is doing that for everyone's careers.
Yes.
And it's really hard, right?
Yeah.
So yes, you have to manage your own career as an entrepreneur, but also create the ability for your team to be successful and your investors to be successful and your clients to be satisfied and you know, recurring. So it's a hundredfold harder than being an employee, but the rewards are also a hundredfold because then you're seeing like your employees thrive, your product thrive, your investors pleased, happy, and paid back. So I think it's a super hard work. It's not for everyone, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about starting a company just because you couldn't find your dream job, it's not the same thing. Like, it's definitely not. But the good thing is that there are, it's even now in what we call the crypto winter, right? There are VCs that are deploying capital. There are founders or co-founders you can find through accelerator programs of all over the world. The world of entrepreneurship now has a huge number of tools that you can tap into. I've been in the UK for about a year now, and I'm in touch with a bunch of accelerators. It's amazing the type of support you get, the type of intelligence you get, the type of access to human resources, like real talent.
Yes.
It's really something. So if you want to try and do it and take your shot at building something that you are happy with and you're satisfied and that solves a problem in the world that you're really passionate about solving, there are ways to make it happen. And yet it's still really hard. So I would definitely encourage, but I would take all of this with a grain of salt and see if this is for you. And hopefully it is.
Yeah, absolutely. That's excellent advice. Having said that, we are just talking about crypto winter. But regardless, there are a lot of opportunities. We recently raised a round as well for one of the companies that I'm working with. And there are just so many opportunities. I wanted to find from your point of view in Web3, where are you seeing the opportunities this year?
Good. Okay. So one thing I learned from Hiro Gertman, the founder of Conduit, is that we're not on the bear market. We are in the beaver market because beavers build during the winter.
Yes.
I'm just using that. I stole this.
I love that quote, by the way.
Where did I see that? And then I ran into Hiro's post the other day, and oh, this is where I saw it, because he was the only one using it. And I was, I'm going to steal this. And then I credit him for that. And I think it's a great way to see this, right? If you are a builder, you should not care whether prices are going up or going down because the technology is the same, right?
Yes.
Now, if your product that you're building only works on a market with high prices, what are you solving for? You have to think about that, right? So if your product, especially in DeFi, if it only works when prices go up, then it doesn't.
Yeah.
If only works when price goes down, then it might. But you have to think about products that work regardless of where the prices of digital assets are. Otherwise, you're just speculating with the technology. So I think that's where the beaver market works for me, is to project that builder mindset regardless of the season. So I think that's really important. That said, Web3 still has some interesting challenges that builders can address. So I'm seeing more and more people come out and talk about UX design.
Yeah.
More and more people, more and more companies are discussing, how can I build better UX? And what's happening, helping building better UX? AI.
Yeah.
Because the provocation of AI for crypto is not just intelligence and data and all of that stuff, but also adoption was so easy because it was just a chat prompt.
Yeah.
Exactly. If you're listening to this and you've never used ChatGPT or the LLM tools that are out there, just please go do that. You're on the internet. You have no excuses to use that. It's for free.
Yes.
Just bear in mind that you don't need to put everything on the chat prompt. Please don't. Don't put your
social security number or anything like that. Yes.
Oh, no. Or your private keys or your seed phrases. Don't. Please don't.
Yeah.
But that said, the ease of use and the value that it gave because it was easy to use was so in your face that adoption was ridiculously fast. This wasn't the case for crypto because crypto requires you to be a freaking engineer to use it, right?
Yeah.
So I keep discussing with some of my friends and even on social media, I said, UX is where it's at. Whoever fixes the UX in crypto wins the game. And I'm happy to see more and more come out of crypto that helps us do that. So one recent evolution that I'm very positive about, and I'm seeing both early stage startups and ages old corporates experimenting with, is the new Ethereum standard for account abstraction, ERC-4337, mm-hmm. because this new standard allows some very interesting things. So everyone complains about gas fees, right?
Yeah.
In public blockchains. Oh, because the gas fees this, the gas fees that. To me, high gas fees are a feature, not a bug. This is how the network is protected, right? Now, one thing that bothers me about gas fees is that I have to think about and do the math to see how much I'm going to spend on a transaction, depending on how fast I want this transaction to be processed. Now, with account abstraction, you can actually have a Paymaster smart contract to handle that for you. Look at that. It's amazing. It could either use native crypto assets that are sitting on your wallet, or it can use native crypto assets that are sitting on other wallets that the contract manages and pays it for the user. So the user doesn't even have to spend that money. And it can do that using native crypto assets like Ether, but it can also use a swap function and exchange whatever other token you have, like a ERC-20, and exchange that and pay for the gas with that token. So the possibilities that we're having in that front to reduce friction without necessarily reducing the security of the network, to me, are a special moment in crypto. I'm much more excited about that, for instance, than I am with the soulbound token standard, right? The token that you can't move from a wallet. I'm much more excited about, I think it's the 6056 or 65 NFT standards, the nestable standard, where you can have an NFT own other NFTs or an NFT own other fungible tokens. The amount of combinations that we can build in terms of new business models and use cases with us, even in the real world, because remember, this is the type of asset relationship that we have in financial services. A company can own a company that can own a company that can own a product. If you nest all of that in terms of an NFT at a very atomic level, what does that mean for digital assets? How much more sophisticated yet traceable can digital assets be? So this is the type of thing that I'm excited about, because this gives builders that haven't found ways to bring their businesses on chain new ways to think about how to do that. And this is very special.
Yeah, that's very cool. I'm sure some people complain about the gas fees, but then there's not only like layer one, but there's layer twos, there's ZK rollups, there's optimistic rollups. There's so many new technologies out there that are continuously reducing the transaction costs, increasing, and they work on top of Ethereum. So Ethereum is like used as layer one, so use the security of layer one, but then use the transaction speed and the low cost of layer two. So there's still, and there's going to be more layers as we go on, and it's only going to get more efficient. But there is still, I feel like there is still a fundamental issue with, even though I work in this field, I still feel like there's a fundamental issue of the whole debate around centralization and decentralization. We are doing all these things to put things on chain, and we are solving these problems that arise because we have put things on chain. The end user doesn't really care about on-chain. They really don't care about my parents. They don't really even understand internet banking very well. So they don't really care about on-chain and off-chain and centralization and decentralization. To them, the key problem is forgetting passwords. They forget Facebook password every month, so they just create a new account. You can't do that with on-chain. So it's like, that's the level of, there's 8.5 billion people. We can't take everyone to be the first 10 million users as the crypto has now. Everyone to be have that level of sophistication. And even in Bitcoin, 20% of Bitcoin is lost because people have lost their keys and stuff. So there is a shortcoming of crypto. How do we solve it?
So I think the things like account abstraction standards will definitely help with that, because one of the features you can build on top of that is the social recovery for seed phrases and private keys and whatnot. So I think we'll get there. Will it be as easy as Web2 logins in terms of, because the easier it is, the less secure it also is.
Yeah.
So we'll need to find that optimum sweet spot between one and the other. Yes. And I trust we will. There's also something that is a generational shift, right?
Yeah.
The people that exist in the world now is not the same people that will exist in the world in 10 years' time when these things are going to become more mainstream. So there's a 10, 15 year improvement window and a 10, 15 year education window that we need to work on for these things to become more and more ubiquitous, but definitely problems to be solved. I tell my degen friends, degens are the NFTs or DeFi degenerates, as they call themselves. I tell them, listen, as much as this works for you, it cannot possibly work for 8 billion people. Not now, not in 20 years. Not everyone will want to be their own bank, because
exactly being
your own bank means you're running bank like risks.
Yeah.
Do you want to be running bank like, I personally don't. So yeah, it's different. So I think we'll find, and I really like that metaphor from the guys from Bankless. They coined the term DeFi mullet. There's even like a meme. I'll send you the meme later. There's a meme. So DeFi mullet means you're fintech in the front and DeFi in the back, which kind of speaks what you said, which is people will use this as they were using fintechs. They don't even know that there's a DeFi protocol running in the back. And they don't care, as they shouldn't care, because if it works, it fades into the background.
Exactly.
I like the, there's a Homer Simpson meme where he's fading into the bushes, like he's breaking into the bushes and he disappears within the bushes. And that's what happens with technology. The moment it works, it disappears. And I think we're going to get there. I've been studying this since 2014. And I've been working professionally on this since 2017. I can't wait for the day where I don't need to talk about blockchain. Like, really?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the magic, how things work, how they solve problems, how interest is better managed and risks are better managed. And now you can hedge stuff real time without having to pile on a lot of cap. Like all of these things that are really interesting things that need to be solved in financial services. That's the one. Absolutely right. Yes. Fintech in the front, DeFi in the back. That's the DeFi mullet. So yeah, 100%. I fully agree. And I'm happy to see that there's more work being done in that, not only at the application layer, but also at the protocol layer. All of these ERCs that I mentioned have been tested and deployed as part of the Ethereum ecosystem. So if you're an Ethereum developer, you can use that. If you're a layer two developer at Ethereum, like on a Polygon or an Arbitrum or an Optimism, whatever your layer two of choice is, these standards are now available to you too. So it's not proprietary. And that's also the beauty of crypto and why we move so fast is because everything is open source, right?
Absolutely.
For better or worse, you're building in the open. And if we make a mistake, everyone will see it, but a bunch of people will rush to fix it as well.
Yes. Oh, open source always wins. There is no competition because you can only have like few hundred employees in a closed source and it's not going to be maintained. It's not going to have the same motivation. Open source wins hands down. And that's a lesson that Microsoft had to learn over the decades and decades of working as a company. And now they support everything open source and stuff, but they didn't used to be like that. And that's something that the rest of the world can learn.
They own GitHub. They need to support open source.
Yes. No, but now they do. They didn't used to be like that back in the late 80s and 90s and all that. And
yep.
And then they changed because they realized that the open source, you can have so many more people working on it and it can be growing and at much faster rate, or they will just lose. Yeah. They will just lose out to it.
So yeah,
they
yeah. Had to you cannot outpace
open source.
Everyone.
Yeah. You cannot outpace everyone. Yeah,
like, you're not,
you cannot hire every single developer in the world. That's what you have to do if you want to beat open source.
No, absolutely. Interesting you say this, because when I joined IBM back in 2015, there's like the whole like induction process. You get a bunch of training, like culture and compliance, etc. One of the trainings we had, and we had to renew it every year, was the open source policy training. And I was like, wait, what? Yeah, we can use open source. Here's how we do it.
Yes.
You can actually contribute open source. This is how we do it. And I'm like, oh, this is so cool.
Yeah, that's why.
I would never expect that. And I'm like, that's the right path forward for sure.
And nowhere else is this as evident as Web3. Because if you want your chain to survive, you want people building on it. If no one is using a chain, that chain is dead in the water.
Zombie chains.
Yes.
We heard of zombie chains.
Yes,
absolutely.
So that is very true in this space, I think. Yeah, talking about this, what are some of the mistakes Web3 founders make?
Launching tokens too soon, I think, is the one critical.
Yeah.
If you talk with Kier Filon-Bates, Blockchain Gandalf, my good friend, he'll say that 99.9% of startups will never need a token.
Exactly.
He's probably right. But if you didn't find the reason to have a token on your business model, then don't. I'll give you an example from Brazil that I really like.
Yes.
Odds Finance is a DeFi protocol for structured financial products. They do a lot of hedging. They do a lot of leg composite products. Very sophisticated, because the three founders came from financial services and they quickly realized that the space needed some of that tooling for investors. So they built it and they have been very successful. I interviewed two of their founders, very generous founders, very open. And I asked the questions, like, they launched the protocol and then they launched a celebratory NFT. And I'm like, oh, this is great. Are you going to launch a Pods token anytime soon? Maybe a governance token? What is the plan there? And Babi, the founder, she said, we don't want to run the race of the regulator. We want to run the race of innovation. So if we launch, this becomes why we exist. We're not going to launch this because the product is why we exist.
Exactly.
And I'm like, that's probably the best answer I've ever heard about this.
Yeah.
But if you go to crypto Twitter, everyone is asking when token. And because this is the 300 something million degenerates that think that this is why crypto exists.
Yes.
And if crypto exists just for that, we're in the wrong industry. But if crypto exists to solve more pressing financial services problems or humanity problems, if you will,
yes,
then we're in the right industry. Because it's open and permissionless, we decide what to build. And I'm really excited to see that coming out from Pods. It's like the right approach to things. No wonder they bootstrapped for almost 2 years, and then they raised late last year after FTX was announced. They raised, I think it was the seed round, like 6 million.
Nice. Yeah.
That tells you a lot about who they are and what they're building.
Yeah. I am of the same belief that most of the startups don't need and will never need a token. They are just doing it as a quick money grab, but it's a death sentence on that startup. And what a lot of startups don't realize it is that running a token is like running a company in itself. It is such a big commitment. It has so many moving pieces with regulation and all sorts of things and marketing and promotion. It's pretty much like running a whole another product, whole another company, that you are going to get distracted and you will not have enough resources. Everyone will be working on focusing on that. And the price going up or down takes a huge emotional toll on everyone involved in that team. So it is like the death sentence pretty much doing that.
But there's a flip side of that as well, right? When I was a enterprise service seller, if you will,
yes,
I had clients call me like, oh, I need to do a blockchain project. My initial answer was, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Because if this is where you're starting, then you have no problem to solve. If you're starting with the technology, you have zero problems to solve.
Yeah.
Unless you're a technology company, which most of them are not. So why would you want to do that? Oh, because I have this problem that I think blockchain will help me solve. If you're a hammer, every problem is a nail, right? Yes. You're going to have to hit everything. And that's why I try to avoid like the plague with blockchain. If everywhere needs a blockchain, then we don't need a blockchain, right? But in the cases where blockchain really solve things, they're probably the one thing that solves that thing. So yes, we're very early. Yes, we're experimenting. Yes, 90% of what we're building now is not going to see the light of the day in 10 years from now. Yes, but the amount of learning we're going to give ourselves because we're building in the open, we're being criticized, we're making mistakes. Some of us are going to jail, rightfully. Some of us are going to jail because regulators don't understand what we're doing and they think they do. But some of us are going to be very successful because we're going to have solved real world problems.
Yeah.
And this is where I think we should operate as an industry, because this gives us a little bit more credibility when talking with regulators and legislators and lawyers and law enforcement. And it's our job to educate them. It's not anyone else's. Oh, they should know better. Yeah, but they don't. And if we don't do our part in telling them what better looks like, then it's on us.
Yes.
So that's why I keep doing the podcast, the lectures, the mentoring, the advisory. I'm not going to solve everything personally, individually. That's not up to me. I'm part of a larger industry. But people like the Bankless guys who, you know, at times don't nail it in the head. You have Ms. Sari, Brian Selke is doing amazing
yes.
work. You have Jamie Burke doing amazing work. You have a number of high-end people in the market actually discussing things in the real way, like Frank from The Scoop and Camilla from The Defiant. These
yes.
are all very serious people, and they understand the implications, and they also understand the old world, and they are helping yeah. to bridge that piece of education as they build their own businesses. So I think we should try and do the same. Even if you're a founder, oh, I don't have time to educate the market, maybe you're in the wrong seat, because you have to be.
Yeah.
You have to be.
Yeah. The more I work with a developer tool company, the more I realize how important education is, teaching people from Web 2 who are just moving into Web 3 how to develop things, how to create things in this space, so they can become the people who go and solve problems. That brings me to the question that, what do you say when people ask you, what problem does blockchain solve, or what problem does Web 3 or crypto solve? What do you tell them?
I think we need to pick that apart in various ways, right? Because we're talking about an infrastructure. You can ask the same about TCP/IP. What problem does TCP/IP solve? And
yeah.
then Tim Berners-Lee will say communication. And
yeah.
Satoshi Nakamoto would say self-sovereign money. And
yeah.
to each their own, right? I think blockchains are pieces of infrastructure. And the moment we realize that this is what they are, and we start to address them as such, we'll have a better understanding of what we can build on that infrastructure to solve problems that no other infrastructure can solve. the double spend problem is a classic solution. Right now you have valuable native digital assets, which you couldn't before Bitcoin, and now you can over 20,000 cryptocurrencies that we have. Do we need 20,000 cryptocurrencies? I don't think so, as we don't need most of the NFT collections that are out there either. But it is permissionless. You don't get to tell people what to do and what not to do. So that is also something we'll learn how to live with, which is the new decentralized paradigm. It's permissionless, it's digital, it's 24/7, it's borderless. How do you stop that? You need to shut down the internet. You shut down the internet? No, because now your whole economy dies. So you have to understand and learn how to live with that. Now, if you ask me what's the killer app right now in crypto, I will say stablecoins.
Yeah, 100%.
And why would you say this, Mauricio? Because stablecoins are the closest thing to digital money we have right now.
Yeah.
Because it is a store of value, it is a unit of account, and it is means of exchange. And this is all you need for money to exist.
Yeah.
So this is the closest we have to like real form digital money. And you can argue that they are not 100% pegged, but they still have a lag into the traditional financial world. Yeah, that's all true. But that doesn't take away that they are currently the killer use case for money remittance.
Oh, 100%.
Across the world, right?
Yeah.
You can say, well, the gas fees, Mauricio, and then I'll say, go use USDC on Polygon.
Yeah, exactly right. Yes. And try moving 100,000 on USDC or Polygon and try moving 100,000 through fiat, and you'll see which has more transaction fees.
I'll go one step further. Go try and move that in $1 bills.
Yeah. Yeah, and see what has more friction.
Yeah. And also, I think we will be forced to realize this, which is unfortunate, is that decentralization implies censorship resistance. And it doesn't matter until it really does.
Yes.
Because when you're censored anywhere else, and you find that you can't exist digitally on the world of blockchains or public blockchains, it changes your perception of what's right and what's wrong with the world. So I hope we don't get to claim that as the one killer use case for public blockchains, but it's there if we need it. With the current state of the world, we don't know what's happening. We don't know what will happen, but we now have a self-sovereign, censorship-resistant data infrastructure we can use if we need to. And this is probably enough for us to keep fighting for this to exist.
Excellent. Excellent. On that note, excellent point to move towards the end of the podcast. On that note, do you have an ask? Is there anything you're looking for? Anything, whether it's for 11FS or for one of the startups that you are on the board for? Feel free to share.
Yeah, I would encourage people to check on some of the startups that are more prominent. The two of those that I have been closest associated with are BlockBR and TuneTraders. BlockBR is going to start a new round of fundraising in a couple of weeks. So if you guys are interested in real-world tokenization in regulated markets, this is what the guys do. Cassio is doing a great job with the team there. And TuneTraders has recently published a white paper. And we're going to do, look at that, a token launch, because now it makes sense for us after 3 years working on a vertical in music. We now pivoted TuneTraders to become the decentralized music protocol. So we'll welcome dApps to build on top of it. So this is ongoing work. And yeah, by all means, just follow us on BlockDrops Podcast, Blockchain Insider Podcast, 11FS. I'm super active on LinkedIn. If you guys want to just ping me on LinkedIn, tell me you heard us on Sam's podcast, and I will be happy to connect. And yeah, I post a bunch of my studies, a regular review reports, other podcasts, articles, and I try to keep that very like in English kind of style without too much of a jargon. So yeah, it's good to trade chops with other people in the industry. And Sam, thank you so much for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you so much for your time and for all your wisdom. I love the quotes that you shared, and it was very inspirational listening to you. My faith has again built in the industry because there are people like you who are still doing the work. And the whole, like nearly an hour we talked, we don't have to talk about token prices or which NFT is going to go up in price or anything like that. And we can work towards solving real world problems instead of you're just looking at the line going up. So thank you. Thank you so much for your time, Mauricio.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for tuning in and listening or watching this episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. By now, you know the drill. Leave a comment or share this episode with a friend and leave a review. I would love to hear from you. So that's why my DMs are open. Reach out to me, especially if you are a founder building a product in Web3. Then I would love to hear from you. What are your challenges? Is there anything that I can help you or my community can help you with? Thank you once again and wish you best of luck in building your startup or your project.